of reuse and recycling ads telling you to take responsibility for waste and environmental care. On the surface, the message is clear that it's you, the consumer, that has to fix this problem. But the tide is now turning since the 1950s. Companies themselves who manufacture harmful, unrecyclable products, such as the burgeoning plastic packaging, are being asked to also take their responsibility. Racer's Edge reporter Thomas Kutis speaks to Jonathan Baker, senior lecturer in strategy at the University of Adelaide, who chronicles how this trend evolved through the years.
Was the subject of a case study that I recently published. The case study goes back to 1950s in the United States and essentially follows this sort of very long story that unfolded over decades of how packaging companies sort of shaped the way that society views the waste streams that are actually produced by them in their manufacturing processes. Starting in the 1950s, Vermont introduced a short-lived piece of regulation that actually banned disposable glass bottles because cows were eating them on the roadside and dairy farmers were complaining that the livestock was being killed. And so this sort of regulatory intervention sort of frightened beverage and packaging firms, and they responded by founding the non-profit organization Keep America Beautiful. Now, it's a non-profit and it was funded by industry, but in its early days, it actually also involved some conservation groups who were also excited to try and clean up American roads. But by the 1970s, many of these conservation groups had pulled out because they realized that Keep America Beautiful and all of the advertising campaigns that they were promoting were actually there to further industry goals. So these advertising campaigns that, for example, introduced the term litterbug into our language, they very much focused on portraying litter as a personal responsibility rather than, of course, trying to tackle production of packaging, disposable packaging at the source. And disposability, of course, was in the interests of industry. It was much more profitable because it meant that glass and plastics firms could start to produce many more of their products. And it also allowed beverage companies to engage in sort of highly centralized production and bottling of their products. In so doing, of course, it meant that local reuse systems that had been widespread prior to this period were eliminated, and packaging sales could increase a great deal.
You were talking about before Keep America Beautiful, which was one of the organisations. How did that sort of shape public attitudes towards litter and recycling? Was it very effective?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, it's quite an interesting fact that I learned myself. Not only did it set about to shape attitudes towards where responsibility lay for litter, and that was basically at the feet of individual citizens. Plus, of course, it was municipalities who had to pay for the establishment of recycling programs and so forth. But in actual fact, in the early days, these packaging and plastics firms had to train Americans to embrace disposability as a concept. You know, you think about the Depression and World War II years, people were very much into reusing and preserving things. When technology enabled the sort of mass production of plastics and other packaging, the industry players set about to educate Americans on how to dispose or why to dispose of plastic things, so portraying plastics as this real wonder product. And an interesting little phenomenon occurred where when they first introduced those coffee dispensing machines where a little plastic cup drops down and a coffee gets poured into the plastic cup, what they found is that a lot of people using the machines would take the cups away with the expectation of reusing them. And so the plastics industry set about through various campaigns, through, you know, good housekeeping and magazines like this, to actually teach people that plastics were things that should be disposed of, that they were a single-use item. So in the context of today, it's quite remarkable to think back that we as a society once had to be taught disposability.
So why did companies resist container deposit legislation and instead promote voluntary recycling programs.
And that was an interesting thing that emerges through the case study, is that through Keep America Beautiful, of course, industry were trying to promote initially litter, but then later recycling as this individual and municipal responsibility. And then on the other hand, they were also fighting back against the introduction of container deposit laws in states throughout the country. And even today, not many states in the US, certainly a small minority, have container deposit schemes today. And so it's quite interesting, you know, on one hand to be trying to promote cleaning up after yourselves and communities and individuals taking responsibility, at the same time as also genuinely fighting back against something, a solution that might have contributed to actually sort of solve or go get closer to solving the problem. So yes, the campaigns were very effective, as well as their lobbying in different sort of state legislatures and Washington DC and so forth.
How did the recycling symbol come to be used on plastics that weren't actually recyclables?
Yeah, and that's an excellent question.
Yes.
So this happened in the late 80s, and the paper and cardboard industry back in the early 70s had introduced the recycling logo, so with the three chasing arrows, and had obviously put it on all of their products, which are truly recyclable. And the plastics industry themselves, and they argued also that conservation groups were involved as well, but in an effort to try and drive this individual responsibility for plastics recycling, they started to have the symbol added to the bottom of different plastics products. Now, at the time, the industry itself was aware that recycling of all plastics was not technically feasible, nor was it going to ever, or, you know, in the near term, it wasn't going to be economically viable. But what they did is that they added into the center of the triangle, obviously the little numbers that we still see today, these are called resin identification codes, which correspond to the type of material that the packaging is made from. So they did quite a smart job. That later on, they did actually admit as an industry that this was a greenwashing tool, and they were trying to work out, you know, how to better use it. But it became institutionalized.
And
why
was it considered a greenwashing tool?
Well, because the numbers that correspond to the different types of material on the bottom of the bottles mean that a number of those different materials weren't recyclable, and many of them still are not. More recycled today than they were back in the 80s, but nevertheless, very, very small number of those different products, those different resins, were actually recyclable at the time. And it created this phenomenon called wish cycling, where consumer confusion was high. People didn't know what to do with different forms of packaging with recycling logos on it, but the different numbers. So they would throw it in the recycling bin in the hope that it would be recyclable, but of course just created a whole load of contamination.
Now, in what ways did the plastics industry benefit from promoting recycling as a consumer responsibility?
Yeah, so I guess in the end, it's about profitability.
Yes.
if you can shift the responsibility for the externalities that you create onto other actors, so in this case, municipalities who are faithfully trying to set up recycling collection and sorting schemes, and individual citizens who are desperately trying to make sense of all of these different recycling logos, then it's good for your profitability. If you're a plastics firm, you can continue to manufacture products out of virgin materials. And if you're a beverage manufacturer or a retailer for that matter, then of course if you're not involved in the cost that's borne, then that's also good for the bottom line.
So, Jonathan, what do you say about Australia's current recycling system in addressing structural packaging waste? Do you think that we are improving, or do you think that we're not doing such a good job?
I certainly think, certainly as a New Zealander living in Australia, I think Australia generally does an excellent job. I think the container deposit schemes that are in a lot of states seem to be mostly effective. But it's interesting to note that, that the return rate here in Australia is only about 65%. And if we look at the Eurozone, we see that, you know, upwards of 90% of bottles and cans are being recovered. So I think there's more that can be done there. But recently, actually just this year in Tasmania, they've introduced reverse vending machines. So essentially located at, you know, different parts of the cities, you can take your bottles and cans, feed it into the reverse vending machine, and then you get a credit back. When I've used these machines in Germany, I just think it's fantastic because it forces retailers to take their role in this whole sort of recycling problem. You know, if they're going to retail these products, then they should probably be involved in you know, having these reverse vending machines on site and collecting these different types of waste.
So you said that as consumers, as Australian consumers of packaging, that we are doing well in our recycling, but we also need to keep further improving. But I guess, do we need to sort of bring in policy reforms that would shift responsibility back to the producers and designers of these packagings?
Absolutely. There's been some interesting developments again in Europe, where they are mandating a minimum proportion of packaging has to be made with recycled materials, which I think is a great way, and it's being incrementally introduced, so sort of being phased in over a period of years, so that essentially policymakers are driving firms themselves to have to introduce more recycled materials into their packaging production. So I think that's the kind of thing that would be ideal to introduce.
Jonathan Baker is Senior Lecturer in Strategy at the University of Adelaide. Speaking there were Racist Edge reporter Thomas Kutis, and ending that report.